Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where your dreams can find a voice. I'm your host, Celine Chenoy. Thank you to all of you who return every week to tune in to become a better version of yourself. Make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already, and rate our show if you enjoyed this episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dreamcatcher Podcast, a place where your dreams can find a voice. I'm your host, Celine Chenoy. Thank you to all of you who return every week to tune in to become a better version of yourself. Make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already, and rate our show if you enjoy this episode. Awakening is the greatest adventure we can undertake as human beings. My guest, Steve Taylor, says it's a voyage of discovery that reveals exhilarating beauty and richness, but may also expose us to challenges. As travelers, cultivating certain characteristics and perspectives can make our voyage more fruitful. Today, Steve will guide us on this path of enlightenment. Steve Taylor, PhD, is the author of The Adventure, A Practical Guide to Spiritual Awakening, and many other best-selling books. He's a senior lecturer in psychology at Leeds Beckett University and the chair of the Transpersonal Psychology section of the British Psychological Society. Steve's articles and essays have been published in over 100 academic journals, magazines, and newspapers, and he blogs for Scientific American and Psychology Today. In this conversation, Steve offers step-by-step practices for cultivating spiritual awakening and explains its impact on our lives. He'll touch on the 8 essential qualities of wakefulness and how we can integrate those into our daily lives through rituals and practices. Hello, Steve. How are you doing today?
Hi, Celine. I'm fine. Thanks. Great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. I enjoyed reading your book, The Adventure, and your unique approach to the process of awakening. And it really, really got me thinking about the whole process. And I'm really looking forward to discussing some of the concepts that you covered in the book with our community today.
Me too. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too.
So, Steve, let's start talking about the book and what inspired you to write it.
It was, it began a long time ago when I became a psychologist. And as a psychologist, my primary motivation was to investigate spirituality and spiritual experiences from a psychological perspective. And that really began with my own experiences. So I wanted to understand my own experiences, which I'd had since a teenager. I'd had sort of spiritual experiences of oneness with my surroundings and feelings of harmony and kind of euphoria for no particular reason. So over the years, I did a lot of research on spiritual awakening and people who'd had temporary experiences and people who'd shifted into an ongoing state of wakefulness or enlightenment. So I wanted to kind of summarize everything I'd learned about spiritual awakening based on my own experiences and based on my research. So the book is a kind of summary of everything I've learned, you know, as a human being and as a psychologist about spiritual awakening.
And can you give us an example of a spiritual experience you had as a teenager? Because that's quite young, I mean, to have such deep and profound experiences. So can you tell us about one of them that really sticks out for you?
I had quite a few of them, but they were all fairly similar because they all happened in natural surroundings. And I was born in a big city, Manchester in England, but I was always drawn to natural spaces, even if it was just the playing fields at my school or the local park. And I used to sort of wander around in the dark, in the park, or usually on my own. And occasionally everything around me would sort of shift into a different perspective. Everything around me would become more real and more beautiful, and the clouds would seem that like they were sentient beings, and everything seemed to sort of shine with a radiance, and everything seemed to be interconnected as if I always felt that there was something, some sort of spiritual energy which lay behind all things, and everything was a manifestation of this sort of spiritual energy. So everything was brought into oneness by this underlying spirit. And yeah, everything just seemed to be in harmony. And I was just filled with this sense of, wow, you know, in some ways I was a typical teenager. I suffered from depression and was quite confused. But in these moments, everything kind of dissolved away. And I just felt so at ease and so in harmony with the world and myself. And as I say, I had those experiences quite regularly.
Yes. And I think it's quite common to get that feeling of oneness when you're in nature. But are there other ways that we can feel that way? Because for me, I experience it when I listen to music or I watch a really moving performance.
Yeah. Yeah, there are lots of different methods. I think nature is probably one of the most common ways in which it arises. But as you say, it can also arise in connection with music, in connection with certain activities like running or swimming, certain physical activities, also meditation. You know, in meditation, you obviously go inward rather than focus outward. But in meditation, you can sense an inner oneness. You sort of travel below the surface of your being and sense a fundamental energy within you, which is also the energy, the fundamental energy of everything else. And also, in my writings, particularly in this book, I focus on altruism, because altruism, like service or kindness, that's a great way of experiencing oneness in connection with other people. You know, when you serve somebody, or when you act altruistically to somebody, you feel a connection with them. You become one with them. And, you know, if you live a life of service, if altruism is kind of ingrained into your daily life, then, you know, that becomes, you know, your ongoing experience. You experience a constant sense of oneness with other people, and maybe not just with other people, but with something essential, a kind of essential spirit behind, you know, behind all things.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But unfortunately, most people today are looking for, well, they think they'd find that happiness and that sense of connection through other ways. They do it through attention seeking or getting stimulated with things that are not really good for them. So do you think that could be the reason why we're sort of having a spiritual crisis?
I think so. But I think I don't think it's necessarily a modern problem. Maybe in the modern world, there are so many different ways in which we can divert our attention outside ourselves. There are so many distractions and so many activities and entertainments. It's really easy to lose yourself in stimulation and entertainment. But I think a lot of people go for, I mean, I think the initial phase that many people go through is to seek happiness outside themselves, to seek happiness through entertainment, through pleasure, through achievement and success. But at a certain point, many people realize maybe you get a certain level of achievement, you have a certain amount of pleasure, and you have an intuition that this isn't really working. You know, it's kind of quite nice. It's nice to be successful. Nothing wrong with it. It's nice to have pleasures, but it doesn't bring you kind of deep fulfillment. You know, it doesn't satisfy you deep within. So I think at a certain point, people begin to realize that that's not really the way to find fulfillment. You have to turn away from the external world and begin to focus on your inner being. I think maybe a lot of people are beginning to realize that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure the people who are listening to this podcast are the ones who are already there, and they are on that quest of awakening, which you actually describe as the greatest adventure we can undertake as human beings. So can you please say more about that?
Well, in relation to what I've just described, I mean, you know, as a culture, as a society, for many centuries now, we've been focused on kind of exploring the external world through colonizing the world, through, you know, conquering different environments and kind of stamping our authority all over the planet Earth, and even exploring space, exploring the oceans. But now, you know, now that the world has practically been totally explored and, you know, and colonized, it's time for us to embark on the inner journey. It's time for us to turn our attention away from the external world and enter the inner world, which is terra incognita for many people. You know, it's an unfamiliar place because most people live entirely outside themselves. So it's time for us as a culture to turn inward and begin to explore the inner world, all these inner continents that we can, you know, that can bring deep fulfillment and contentment.
And you offer a framework for people to do that. You describe 8 qualities of wakefulness, and I would love for you to take us through each one of them briefly.
Okay, yeah, I'd be glad to. These 8 qualities, they partly emerged from my research into spiritual awakening, because I interviewed over 100 people who reported spiritual awakening, and they kept mentioning these 8 essential qualities. And, you know, I've experienced them myself in my own life. I also did a survey of the world's spiritual traditions, all the spiritual paths and practices from different cultures around the world. And all these are the essential qualities which are emphasized in those traditions too. So I'm not saying that these are the only qualities of spiritual awakening, but they seem to be the most fundamental. And the first one is to disidentify with the ego or the thought mind. That's important because most human beings spend most of their time immersed in their thoughts, and they derive their identity from their thoughts. Their mood is determined by their thoughts. But when maybe the initial phase in spiritual awakening is to realize that you are not your thoughts, that you are the observer of your thoughts. So you become aware of a space between you and your thoughts. And, you know, the deeper into awakening you go, the more expansive that space becomes. So that's disidentification from the ego. And in some ways, that's the first, it's kind of like the gateway into spiritual awakening. Once you pass through the gateway, you move on to the other characteristics. And the second quality I discuss is gratitude, or overcoming the taking for granted syndrome, or being aware of all of the blessings, all of the precious things in our lives without them becoming familiar.
Mm-hmm. I would like to dig into the taking for granted syndrome, because I think it's quite pervasive in our society. We have this sense of entitlement, and we forget that a lot of the conveniences that we have now really didn't exist, say, even like 50 years ago. So can you tell us a little bit about that, please, the taking for granted syndrome, and how we can overcome that?
It seems to be one of the biggest obstacles to human happiness, the fact that we take everything in our lives for granted, and even life itself. And one of the major transformations that happens when people have a confrontation with death, maybe a diagnosis of cancer or a recovery from an accident or an emergency, is that they, at least for a while, they stop taking life for granted. So they become aware of the value of the people in their lives, all of the precious human beings around them, who maybe they normally take for granted. They become aware of the preciousness of the simple things, like just to eat, just to drink, just to look around and see the beauty of nature, just to be able to walk. They become aware of the value of their bodies. You know, normally we take our bodies for granted, but in reality, there are millions of microscopic processes taking place in the body every moment to keep us healthy and alive. And it's incredibly miraculous when you look into it. And then the fact of being alive itself in this world, in this moment, is a miracle, you know, especially when you compare it to, you know, death. Even if you believe in some kind of life after death, it's still a miracle to be here and now in this form. But maybe in some ways, because we have to focus on practical things in our lives, we switch off to these blessings. We just turn off to them. And that, you know, it deprives us of a really essential source of happiness, which comes from appreciation and gratitude. So, you know, I have a number of exercises that I recommend to try to overcome the taking for granted syndrome. One of them is simply what I call self-reminding. You know, we become aware of the value of our blessings when maybe we see other people who don't have these things, who lack these blessings. We think, oh, wow, you know, I'm so lucky to have these things. Or when these things are taken away from us for a while, like when you become ill, or when you lose all your possessions for a while, or when maybe your partner leaves you, maybe because you've been taking them for granted, you become aware of how valuable they are. But we don't need to wait for that. We can remind ourselves. And research in psychology shows that once you practice a habit for a certain amount of time, for a few weeks, it becomes ingrained into you. So what I suggest is that, you know, if you habitually remind yourself of your blessings, then within a short space of time, it will become habitual for you to be aware of them.
Yeah, I love that. I actually had to remind my brother to do that last week because he had just gone to a friend's house, and his house was apparently like magnificent. It was a mansion and it had a beautiful garden, a beautiful pool. And he just went on and on about how amazing it was. And I kind of had the feeling that it was causing a sense of deprivation in him. Mm. So I had to remind him that, hey, we have a pretty good life too. You know, you have a nice house, and of course there are going to be people who are better off, but that doesn't mean that we don't have a great life, that we don't have nice home.
No.
We're way better off than most people on the planet, statistically. Yeah. So I had to remind my brother of that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I sometimes think that if we could go back in time 150 years, you know, if we could just experience what life is like 150 years ago for people here in England or in America, anywhere maybe, then, you know, that would stop us taking things for granted because we're so privileged. Most of us are so privileged compared to early human beings.
Yeah, history gives us great perspective, for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think we were on the second
quality. Yeah.
So we're going to move on to the third one.
Yeah, the third one is presence or living in the now. That simply means no longer, not habitually contemplating the future or the past, but being centrally or mainly focused on your experience in the present. Then the fourth quality is altruism, which we already discussed, or giving to the world. And that's one of the most, when people undergo spiritual awakening, they often experience a shift from living in a mode of accumulation, which is when you try to accumulate success or achievement or possessions. They shift from that into a mode of contribution so that they no longer take from the world, they give to the world. So that's a really important shift.
That's when you know you are really on the path to awakening, right? When you start prioritizing contribution over, you know, accumulating stuff and just increasing your possessions.
That's right. Yeah, precisely. Yeah. And that's, you know, people are no longer concerned with their own success or achievement. You know, they derive most of their happiness and fulfillment from helping others, from alleviating people's suffering or helping their community or contributing to the human race more generally through their creativity or through their spiritual evolution. Yeah, that is a major shift.
Okay.
The next one is acceptance, which means no longer resisting the reality of our predicament in life. And
that's a hard one.
That's a hard one. Yeah, it's tricky. But, you know, it's like, I mean, the past is a good example. A lot of people struggle with accepting the past because maybe they've been through difficult experiences. Maybe people have mistreated them in the past. So they feel a certain degree of resentment, maybe guilt or embarrassment because of their past experiences. But you have no choice but to accept the past. You can't change the past. So you have no choice but to accept it. No matter how painful it may have been, you have to accept it. And I'm not saying it's easy, but you have no choice but to do that eventually. And when you do that, when you accept the past and you realize that there's no point dwelling on it because it's gone, you can't change it, then that's liberating. On the one hand, it makes you more present. On the other hand, it frees you from those negative emotions that are associated with the past. But more generally, acceptance creates a sense of harmony with you, between you and your life, because you're no longer resisting the reality of your life.
Yes. And I would imagine that is more for process rather than something that would happen in a short period of time, especially if it's a very difficult experience or circumstances that you're trying to get over.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, obviously, there are probably many things in our lives that we struggle to accept to some degree or other. So it is a process. But I recommend a kind of therapeutic process in the book, a four-stage process of moving from resistance to acceptance. And you know, and you're right. There are certain experiences which are more difficult to accept than others, particularly things like illness, even death itself. You know, is quite difficult to accept. But you know, but I think most people find that when they do move into a mode of acceptance, then it's a transformation. Everything changes because there's no longer this duality, no longer this conflict between you and reality.
And what about nostalgia, Steve? Is that something that you think would prevent us from moving forward in our spiritual awakening journey if we're kind of holding on to past memories and just feeling that longing for what was?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to be moderate about it. I don't want to appear puritanical and tell people you're not allowed to think about the past at all.
Right.
You're not allowed to dwell on any pleasant past experiences, because obviously there's nothing wrong with, you know, remembering pleasant experiences and thinking back to good times. But there is a certain point where it becomes unhealthy, you know, when you start to dwell in the past rather than in the present. And the problem with nostalgia is that if your present life isn't going that well, then you start to think, oh, you know, I wish I was back there. What, you know, what went wrong? And you start to feel more dissatisfied with your present life because it's not as harmonious as it was or as it seemed to be in the past. So yeah, I think in moderation, recalling or remembering the past is fine. It's just when it becomes habitual and it starts to detract from presence. The same with the future. You know, there's nothing wrong with looking forward to the future if you've got some pleasant events ahead of you. But when it becomes habitual, then it can stop us being present.
So it's about striking that balance.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm not a Buddhist, but I appreciate a lot of the Buddhist teachings, and the Buddha taught the middle way. You know, we're going to go to any extreme. You want to be moderate, and moderation keeps you balanced. And we always know when you find the balance, you always know, because that's when your life starts to flow harmoniously. There's three more that we were three.
Yes.
More. So the sixth one is integration or harmony with the body. And that's important because sometimes in spiritual teachings, the body is kind of left behind, or it's demeaned, or it's seen as a kind of illusion. But I found that when people go through spiritual awakenings, they have a much more positive attitude to the body. They start to really respect their bodies. They change their diet. They start to exercise more. They really start to look after their bodies because they see their body as something precious. They no longer take it for granted. But they become aware that, you know, it is possible to live in harmony with the body and to treat the body as a manifestation of spirit, as a sacred entity. So that's really important.
Mm. Does that include the process of grounding?
Well, I think when people undergo a shift into an awakened state, they do become naturally grounded, in the sense that they tend to adopt a simple lifestyle. They don't kind of overindulge in pleasures. Again, it's a question of moderation. They don't deny themselves pleasures necessarily, but they become kind of moderate. They tend to live simply in a kind of, you know, and I guess you could describe that as a grounded way, because, you know, they want to feel in harmony with their bodies. And one way to do that is to, you know, treat the body with respect and to live a healthy, simple lifestyle. So the next one is detachment. And that means, what I mean by detachment is that you no longer look for happiness or identity from external things. So it means that you detach yourself from possessions, from achievements, from beliefs, ambitions, from the past and the future. So your identity no longer depends on these attachments, because you have an essential identity which doesn't derive from external things. So there's a process of letting go of attachments, which always takes place in spiritual awakening. And the final quality is embracing mortality, which means acknowledging and accepting the temporary and fragile nature of life in this body, in this world. And I've included that because I've met so many people who've undergone spiritual awakenings through becoming aware of the reality of death through a diagnosis of cancer or another health emergency. And so simply being aware of the reality of death, it makes us more present. It stops us taking life for granted. It affects us positively. Paradoxically, it affects us positively in many ways.
Hmm. Isn't there a meditation in Buddhism where you meditate on your death?
Yeah, maybe the one you think of, it's called the Buddha's Cemetery Meditation.
Right.
And the Buddha instructed his monks that whenever they were sort of wandering around and they found a dead body, which, you know, 2,500 years ago, maybe they would find dead bodies just, you know, in the countryside or on paths. So the Buddha said that when you find a dead body, sit down and meditate next to the dead body and remind yourself that you will become that. And that evolved into the practice of Buddhist monks going to cemeteries to meditate in cemeteries, contemplating the fact that they are, you know, mortal beings and that life is fragile and temporary.
Yeah, and we're not exposed to death so much now. We're just we don't see that nowadays. We don't, unless you live near a graveyard or if you had a death in the family, you're not really privy to
death
it.
It's become a taboo. You know, in the Victorian age, sex was a taboo, and now it's death. The death is a taboo in the 21st century. It's just a shame because, we can gain a lot through being aware of the reality of our mortality. And in the book, I recommend that people do visit their local cemeteries and just sit down and contemplate, you know, the fact that life is fragile and we're only here for a certain amount of time. And because of that, life is incredibly valuable and precious.
And what if any fear comes up for us, Steve? Because, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit scary. You think, oh, my goodness, like my time here is limited. And
that's true. Yeah, there are three possible reactions to death. I sometimes call them the three A's. It's avoidance, anxiety, and acceptance. So avoidance is probably quite common in our society. You know, in the modern world, most people avoid thinking about death because they think it will make them feel depressed. And anxiety is when some people do occasionally contemplate their deaths and it makes them feel anxious, so they go back into avoidance. But most people find that when they seriously contemplate death, when they look at it really directly in the face, maybe that happens through an illness or just through another person, a close family member or loved one passing away, it can actually shift into a mode of acceptance, you know, acknowledging and accepting the reality of death. And most people find that, you know, that it's a bit like, I sometimes compare it to a forest. It's as if you're living outside a forest and you hear strange sounds in the forest and you know it's dark in the forest, you're afraid of it. But when you actually walk into the forest, you find that there's a sense of harmony in the forest. It's beautiful and harmonious. It's spacious. And death is a bit like that. When you're kind of skirting the edges and not really focusing on it, it seems slightly, you know, worrying. It can create anxiety. But when you actually go into it, when you face it, it becomes pleasant. It becomes powerfully transformative.
That's a beautiful analogy.
Yeah. Yeah, I found that that's true. It's true. So many people undergo transformation simply through becoming aware of the reality of their death or their mortality.
Wow. Thank you, Steve, for walking us through those eight qualities of wakefulness. So I've been wondering, is it possible for someone who, you know, who goes through this awakening journey to exist in a world where most people aren't at that level? How can they feel a sense of normalcy when they are different from others?
It can be tricky, especially when people undergo a very sudden and dramatic awakening, which often happens in situations of turmoil or trauma. It can be tricky because suddenly there's a distance between you and your friends or even your partner. You're not quite the same person. So your partner's thinking, what's happened to him or her? You know, I feel like I'm together with a different person. And it can, unfortunately, it can sometimes lead to divorce or separation or the breakdown of friendships. But people almost always find that they gravitate towards new friends and new groups, new partners. And in general, when people undergo awakenings, other people kind of unconsciously sense that there's something attractive about them. They have a kind of radiance about them, which attracts other people towards them. You know, I think it's because they lose their sense of separation. They lose their ego, basically. So there's no longer any sense of defensiveness or protectiveness. There's a sense of openness, a kind of welcoming benevolence about them. So other people are generally quite attracted to them. So they do attract friends very easily, and they gravitate towards other spiritually developed people. You know, they even if they don't know anything about spirituality to begin with, they eventually gravitate towards spiritual paths and practices, and you know, and sometimes they may join a spiritual community or just form friendships with other spiritual people.
Yeah, I think you have to find the right environments, because I've been guilty of experiencing a sense of spiritual elitism, because I was recently in a music festival, and I don't know if you've ever been to one, but if you have, you know that people can get a bit wild out there, and there can be a lot of excessive drinking and, well, they're just having a good time to be fair. But I sometimes find myself drifting into a sense of judgment, and I have to keep that in check. So is that something you see, that you know, people on that path can have a tendency to do that? Because I had to be aware of myself getting into that frame of mind of judging others who are probably in a different level of consciousness?
Yeah, that can be a challenge. You know, it's almost as if, often when you undergo an awakening, it's not a clean break. You sometimes carry over certain traits and, you know, a tendency to, you may carry over certain egoic traits. So you may catch yourself feeling superior, judging other people or feeling proud and arrogant even. But the main thing is, you know, if you're aware of those emotions arising, it shows that you've disidentified from your ego, you know. So if you're aware of them, then you can allow them to pass by without them becoming inflated, without latching onto them. So, yeah, it's good to just sort of stand back and observe those feelings arising, but not latching onto them, and then they will naturally fade away.
Okay. I feel better now after you mentioning that, because I said, why am I feeling this way? I don't want to feel this way. They're just having a good time, you know?
Well, the one thing I found in my own experience is when I was a kind of a young spiritual seeker, when I had my own sort of spiritual experiences in my teens and my early 20s, I did feel superior to in my family. I felt quite dismissive of ordinary people. You know, they're following the wrong path. You know, they don't know what I know. And so I did feel quite elitist. And I felt kind of, you know, a little bit irritated that other people didn't understand me. And I felt a gulf between myself and other people. But, you know, but years ago, that transformed into a sense of empathy for other people. I don't feel elitist anymore. I know that everybody is on their journey and people are at different stages. And, you know, I love everybody, even if they, you know, they've never had a single spiritual experience in their lives.
And how did you get there, Steve?
I don't really know. It seemed to be a natural process. There was just a process of no longer judging, no longer feeling superior. I think it was maybe through meditation, through years of meditation, just developing the ability to stand back and observe my own egoic emotions. And just as I described, eventually they began to fade away. And when they faded away, they were replaced by compassion.
So is it safe to say that you're probably too identified with the ego if you find yourself judging others?
Well, to a degree, but as I say, the fact that you can observe yourself judging others is a really good sign, because it shows that there is a space between you and your ego. So even though, you know, in a sense, it's not a good sign that those emotions are still emerging, in a way, you know, there's also the positive aspect that there is a space between you and those feelings. So it's important not to latch onto them, just to allow them to manifest themselves and pass by. And just, you know, return to a feeling of compassion. I think there's a place in all of us where we feel compassion for other human beings, no matter how different they are, no matter how developed they are. Just return to that sort of heart space where you feel compassion for others.
Yeah. I try just looking at them smiling, being in this absolute state of bliss and joy while they were dancing to the music. So that helped me to get into that state of compassion and really connecting with them on a human level.
Yeah. I think when you see the world from other people's perspective, you know, everybody's going through challenges, everybody's undergoing a certain degree of suffering, and they're responding to it, and they're trying the best they can to find fulfillment, and they're trying to do it in different ways, maybe ways that you've discarded a long time ago. But you know, everyone's got the right to try out their own path to happiness.
Exactly.
Yeah, I had an experience 3 or 4 years ago when I just felt really elated for no particular reason. I was traveling to the town where I work at the university, to Leeds in England, and I just got off at the train station feeling really elated and full of unconditional love. And I had some time and I was hungry, so I went to a pub for a meal. I could see lots of people in the pubs. There were like groups of old men complaining about the world. There were some young guys trying to impress each other. There were some businessmen speaking on their mobile phones, trying to impress each other. But I felt compassion for everybody, because I realized that everybody's trying to find happiness. Everybody's dealing with the challenges of life in their own way.
And that is a byproduct of going on this journey.
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought, actually, in that experience. I do describe that. I write about that experience in the book, and I end the chapter by saying that, you know, we're all on a journey. Some of us are at different stages of the journey, but we're all journeying through life, and we're all undergoing. We all have the same basic needs for love and attention, and happiness, and we're all facing the same, you know, the same kind of existential challenges. So yeah, we're all fellow travelers.
We're all fellow travelers. Well, Steve, I think that's a beautiful note to end our conversation on today. So thank you so much for sharing your profound insights with us. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
So for those who are interested in purchasing a copy of Steve's book titled The Adventure, A Practical Guide to Spiritual Awakening, you can find it in all major bookstores and at his website, stephenmtaylor.com. The link will be in the description.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, please subscribe to my podcast and feel free to share it with your friends and family. Take care and speak soon.